حضرت لاؤ صلوات
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
السلام علیکم ورحمۃ اللہ. بسم اللہ الرحمن الرحیم. All praises are Allah's, Lord of the world. And may His peace and blessings be upon our Master, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and His pure Immaculate Ahlul Bayt.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
First, I'd like to express my happiness to be in the presence of you, brothers and sisters. And it's an honor to be invited by the lawyers committee and the community in general. This first lecture will be an introductory lecture to the next three, inshallah. It starts with a letter which Imam Khomeini wrote in the late 80s to the then president of the Soviet Union. It was called Gorbachev. And although this was a political letter, so it should be regarded rather as a spiritual political letter. It has its political side, but also it had and contained a spiritual message in the letter. And it's this spiritual dimension I want to focus upon. Because although it was regarded as a letter to the President of the Soviet Union, in broader terms, it was regarded as an invitation to Islam, to the West in general, and how Muslims have to invite the West to Islam. And it's that aspect. That's why I'm reading the letter. And then from the letter, there are many branches that one can follow. We'll choose one branch for the next 3 nights, inshallah. So, in the letter, Imam advises Gorbachev to research and investigate Islam. And the reason he says that is, in quotes, "Not because Islam or Muslims are in need of you, but rather to acknowledge that Islam's lofty and global values can constitute the means of comfort and savior for all nations, as well as unknotting humanity's essential difficulties." You see, this is not only to a person or a nation, it's for the West in general, to try and acknowledge the true message of Islam. Now, I'm going to translate four paragraphs of this, and then from the last paragraph, which is the main paragraph which I have in mind, that we need subsequent notes one has to take from that. Imam writes, "Our innate nature, that fitra, pulls us towards acquiring perfection in power and knowledge. Be you a Muslim or a non-Muslim, everyone is driven towards perfection in power and knowledge." And so it made the picture that in its nature which makes that pull. So he says, our innate nature pulls us towards acquiring perfection in power and knowledge. Hence, there exists pure power and knowledge for us to have been attracted to it in the first place. And that source of all power and knowledge is Almighty Allah, to whom we are all heading towards, even if we are not aware of it. People find perfection in different things, but they're all travelling towards Allah, even if they're not aware of it. And Imam elsewhere has spoken that even the idol worshipper is worshipping Allah, but they're not aware of it, because no one but Allah can be worshipped. So even if someone's not aware of it, an they're worshipping the idol, they're worshipping Allah in essence, but they're not aware of it. Iyyaka na'bud. Only Allah can be worshipped. No other entity does it qualify to even label it as worship in relation to any other entity but Allah. Man, Imam continues, wants to reach the absolute truth in order to be annihilated in God, in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the craving and yearn towards an eternal life is incorporated within us all. And this itself indicates the existence of an eternal cosmos that is death-free. Here, Imam is indirectly referring to the fact that the cosmos has no end. It will always be. In the same way that the cosmos has no beginning, you can't trace back to a beginning, because that would entail you believing in a manifestation-less Allah. And that's a deficiency in relation to Allah. And even post-eternally, it will always continue. Prophet Adam, alayhi salam, around 7 to 12,000 years ago, was our cycle, the start of our cycle. After us, end of our cycle, there'll be a new cycle, new prophets, new imams, cycle after cycle. Physical qiyamah after physical. Assuming your excellency, as you look at the etiquette, the adab Imam is using, he was a communist, Gorbachev. He wasn't the best of people, but still, when one wants to do tabligh of Islam, one has to always use the best of manners, whoever the audience is. Something which is quite lacking in interreligious debates sometimes. Assuming your excellency would like to research in these domains, you can instruct the scholars of such sciences to refer to the writings of Farabi and Avicenna, may Allah's mercy be upon them, in addition to books on Western philosophy. So the first line of action when inviting the West to Islam, Imam is advising Gorbachev to instruct your scholars, in addition to the books in Western philosophy, to read the books of two important Islamic philosophers. And that's Farabi and Avicenna. By doing so, it will become evident that the law of causation, cause and effect, is always, this world is filled with causes and effects. This law of causation, upon which all forms of knowledge is based, is rational in nature and not perceived by the senses. And also the perception of universal meanings and concepts upon which all forms of reasoning depends is also rational in nature and not sensible. Not perceived by the senses. In the next paragraph, Imam says, also you can instruct the scholars of such sciences to refer to the writings of Sohrawardi, may Allah's mercy be upon him, on illuminationist philosophy, Ishraqi philosophy, so that they explain to you that the body or any physical existent, physical being, is in entire need of pure light. Yeah, entire need meaning it's dependent upon that pure light existence-wise. And that pure light is sense-free. It can't be perceived by the senses. And that man's inner witnessing of one's self is totally independent from the senses, the essence of what you are. And that unity with the pure light is something that is outside the jurisdiction of the senses, the five physical senses. It's something of a much greater, important, immaterial reality, the essence of what you are. There's one Sufi who referred to the Bible in one of his works, and he said, in the Bible, Allah says, and it's an Arabic text, but there's one tradition in the Bible where he says, ظَاهِرُكَ لِلْفَنَى وَبَاطِنُكَ أَنَا. Your outside dimension, your external side, is to perish. Allah is saying that. But your inner side is me. And that's on a par with our traditions too. The traditions which, from the Holy Prophet, for example, who says, مَنْ عَرَفَ نَفْسَ عَرَفَ رَبَّهُ. One who acquires gnosis of one's self will acquire gnosis, gnosis with a G, of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Then the Moran continues saying, furthermore, request your greater scholars and professors. Before he would say, request your scholars. Now he's saying, request your greater scholars and professors to refer to the transcendental philosophy of Mullah Sadra. May Almighty Allah's pleasure be upon him, and may Allah resurrect him with the prophets and the Salihin, so that it becomes known to them that verily the truth and reality of knowledge is an immaterial existent, and all forms of thought are matter free, and so are not governed by the material and physical rules and laws. All forms of knowledge are matter free. Here, on learning about this concept of knowledge being matter free and being an immaterial reality, here lots of things emanate from this and from Mullah Sadra's writing. And Mullah Sadra isn't, you know, bringing this from his own self. He's basing everything he says on the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt. That's why Imam grants so much honor to him here. Not because of, you know, the person himself. But all forms of knowledge are matter-free. It's immaterial. It's like the soul, which is immaterial. Because you are your knowledge. You are what you know. Your knowledge creates the I. Your knowledge enhances the I existentially. And then your actions that emanate from what you know, that also, when your actions become incorporated within you, you become your actions. These are all immaterial realities. Here, Imam wants to say, learning Mullah Sadra, tell your philosophers to tell you the essence of what you are, and why knowledge is important to who you are. Then Imam finally says, I shan't tire you further, and shall not name books of the Gnostics, the Urafa, especially those of Muhyiddin ibn Arabi, because assuming you desire to be informed of the discussions and writings of this great personality, here you must send a number of your genius specialist experts. Before he would say, send your scholars, or send your greater scholars and professors. Here though, he's saying you send your genius specialist experts who have a strong basis in such matters to Qom. This was around 25 years ago. Here, he didn't say, let them research it, wherever they are in the West. Here, you have to send such people to Qom. So that after several years, with reliance upon Allah, with tawakkul upon Allah, they can become aware of the depths and thinner than hair delicateness of the stations of ma'rifah, For without making such a journey, awareness of such knowledge is not feasible. There's something very important here. That this is how Imam believes that the West have to be invited to Islam through these kind of scholars. At that time, in all, at best, to be most polite, the large majority of the seminary schools in Qom and the scholars regarded Ibn Arabi as a Sunni Muslim. Some regarded him as a kafir. And an imam as a route to inviting the West to Islam mentioned that one has to be aware of such stations of gnosis through his writings. Now, it's not important at all whether he was a Sunni mystic, a Sunni Gnostic, or a Shia Gnostic. Imam believes he was a Shia. Ayatollah Hassanzada Omali, Ayatollah Jawadi Omali, they've proved he was a Shia. But that's not important. Let's just call him a Muslim Sufi for now, a Gnostic who isn't a Muslim. Now, you may hear today many scholars attacking this figure. Imam, many years ago, when Imam had ijtihadin Irfan, he studied Irfan, the classical texts, with the proper mentors. He went through that path, and he had ijtihadin Irfan in his 20s. He had ijtihadin ethics. It's not like me or others who just read a book and then feel that we can give a lecture in ethics by just reading something. No. They've done ijtihad in these sciences. Imam, in addition to being a mujtahid in fiqh in his 20s, had ijtihad in other sciences, including ethics, irfan, philosophy. This is important. The majority of the maraji today, they have ijtihad in fiqh and the sciences related to fiqh, like usul al-fiqh, hadith, rijal, and so on and so forth. But they don't have ijtihad in ethics. The wide majority, they don't have ijtihad in irfan. And therefore, if you see scholars attacking Gnostics such as Ibn Arabi, Imam has written a long time ago that the reason is they don't understand their words. They don't understand it. They haven't studied Irfan, the classical texts, with the necessary teachers. Irfan isn't just about any person just referring to a book in Irfan and thinking they can understand it. It's like in medicine, for example, someone who has no knowledge of medicine just opens a page and then the page reads, "Here you cut the lower abdomen with a knife." And then the person says, "Good grief, this is, they're killers here. Medicine is wrong." It's deep. Irfan is difficult. You can't do it alone. It's like any other science. You have to go through the right path of studying it. So it doesn't matter if some scholars attack it, there's no need for you to tell it. Just as long as you appreciate that, you have to follow people who give opinions on Irfan, for example, those who are qualified to give opinions on Irfan. In ijtihad, each science has its own ijtihad. We do taqlid from our respected maraji because they're experts in fiqh, in halal and haram. But there's no guarantee that they're experts in ethics, in irfan, in tafsir, in philosophy, and so on and so forth. Then Imam finally says, "Finally, allow me to explicitly announce that the Islamic Republic of Iran, as the largest and most powerful headquarters in the Islamic world, can easily fill the doctrinal vacuums of your system and state. That's the potential of this long mass. And Imam said that with the tranquility of the heart, we can easily fulfill the doctrinal vacuums that you're experiencing in the West. Now that's how we have to approach the West and you as ambassadors of Islam in the West. That's what you need to be informed of. You can't teach or propagate Islam to a Western audience, to a non-Muslim audience, based on how you were taught Islam with that cultural baggage associated with it from the East. It won't work. This was the route that Imam suggested. Now, many of you may not go to home and study, but the scholars can simplify the words, those who have studied it, to you, and you can benefit. Then you may be able to be more of an ambassador to Islam. But it's important to appreciate, yes, Irfan has had its people, people who have abused Irfan. Throughout history it has happened, and there's no denying that. But that doesn't mean Irfan has to be discarded as a whole. It's like a doctor who has abused the way he has practiced medicine. It doesn't mean medicine has to be discarded. That doctor, that RF, or so-called RF, has done some wrong. But don't put it aside, because putting it aside, you'd be losing your life. As Ayatollah Hassan Zadeh said, an Irfan-less community is like a spiritless corpse. You see, that is important. Now, why does he say that? It will become evident. But the spirit of religion has to be maintained. You can't limit religion to one dimension. So once, that's the end of the letter. So one's approach to the theoretical dimensions of religion is essential to one's growth. And one shouldn't see religion as unidimensional. Religion has many layers to it. Infinite layers. Infinite esoteric layers. Some of the traditions from the Ahlul Bayt say that every verse has 70 meanings. Inner esoteric meanings. The butun. Some traditions say 700, some say 70,000, every verse. And they're not exaggerating. There is no limit to the Qur'an. One can travel infinitely through the Qur'an. But the Qur'an also has an outer dimension. That outer dimension is important. It's a route, a conduit to the inner dimensions of the world. We can never compromise with the external side of religion. We can never compromise with the Sharia. It's a basic dimension, but it's an essential dimension, without which you can't reach other dimensions of Islam. The Sharia is important. It can't be compromised with. If the Sharia is played around with, if you compromise with the Sharia, you won't benefit further. And if you do, it will be very minimal. But truly exploring the inner dimensions of the religion, it has to be done through a methodology. And the first step, albeit the first step, but it's an essential step, to reach the highest steps, is that of the Sharia. So religion has an exoteric and external side, where knowledge is basic, it's external, it's unidimensional, but it's important to have knowledge. But there's an esoteric side of religion. And the esoteric side of religion is for us to live and breathe Islam from moment to moment in this world. That's the aim with esoteric Islam, with Irfan. The aim is to live and breathe Islam from moment to moment, rather than putting everything in Islam aside and say it will happen one day in the future. Rather than confining the rewards of Islam to the future, regarding death as something which will happen in the future, heaven and hell, something which will happen in the future, the questioning of the angels will happen one day, Barzakh will happen one day, the Sirat will happen one day, Rajat, it will happen one day, Mahdaviyat, Messianism, he will come one day. Instead of putting religion on credit and shifting religion to one day in the future, which is okay, but it's a minimal understanding of Islam. Irfan wants you, in relation to every article of faith, wants you to breathe and live that article of faith right now in this world. Because every article of faith we have in our aqa'id, in our Islamic doctrine, is spirit building. It builds you. The knowledge of that aqa'id builds you. The knowledge itself. And that's why taqleed in aqa'id is haram. You have to get access to that knowledge. You have to accept it rationally, at least. Not because someone has told you, because the knowledge is important here. That knowledge is spirit building. In fiqh and ahkam, the knowledge is not spirit building. Knowing fiqh will not build your spirit. It's the action of that knowledge that builds your spirit. Acting according to the rulings of salat, fasting. Knowing the salat or not knowing it won't build your spirit automatically. It's acting and doing the salat, the fasting, hajj, and all the other ibadat. So there, the action is important. That's why here you can do taqleed, because the knowledge per se isn't essential. So you go rationally, you would want to choose the most learned scholar in fiqh, and then you follow them. So some people go to hajj once a year, some people live Hajj-li, from moment to moment, day to day. Both are important. Islam has given a minimum of the wajibat just to get us going. We can't suffice with the minimum. Islam says salat is 5 times a day. But then the Quran speaks of those who الَّذِينَ هُمْ عَلَى صَلَاتِهِمْ دَائِمُونَ, who are in salat constantly. This is an esoteric code here. Actually, it doesn't mean that you're physically doing salat constantly. It's the essence of salat, through which the physical of wajib salat is a conduit to, is an essence that you have to maintain. But that doesn't mean if you do maintain it, you can leave the external salat. You can never leave that. Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
He had reached all the stages of gnosis. He was in heaven whilst he was living in this world. He had undergone the questioning of the angels, get past the Sirat, whilst living in this world. That's why the tradition says, even if the veils were to go away, it wouldn't increase an iota of his yaqeen. He experienced it all. But he still kept with the external sharia. He never let go of the 5 daily prayers. You can't let go of that. Because if you get absorbed in the esoteric side and discard the exoteric, the Sharia side, you would be drowned in Allah's Jalali attributes, in His attributes of beauty, His love, compassion, His mercy. But you would be oblivious to Allah's Jalali attributes, the Almighty, the All-Conquering, the Omnipresent. You would lose that unity in relation to the Jalali attributes. And if you lose that unity in relation to the Jalali attributes, you would fall spiritually. The aim is to acquire unity with all of Allah's attributes. Those who say, we love Allah, this, that, and the other, and they forget the Sharia, they've lost contact with Allah's Jalali attributes. And then that spirituality will be compromised. I'm not saying they're evil people. They just have these deficiencies. We want to acquire perfection. So the exoteric dimension of the religion can never be compromised with. Expecting anything lesser than this, you're either limiting your vision of Islam or you're wasting yourself. If you confine Islam to one dimension only, let's say only the Sharia, and ignoring the Sharia's inner dimensions, just sticking to the letter of the law, you may even go to heaven. But it's a recreational heaven, it's a minimum heaven. You can acquire much more. Now, I want to go through some topics whereby just mentioning them one by one, and then I'll choose one of them for the next 3 nights. And some of these topics I've mentioned elsewhere, and some of you may have heard them already. I'll try and choose a topic that I haven't spoken about yet. But these topics, I just want you to appreciate how Irfan looks at these topics, how their look, their view on such topics, how it's vitally important in relation to the building of the self. So, starting off with death. Well, we see death as something only for the aged. They reach an age, and then they die. But in Irfan, they see, extrapolated from the traditions from the Ahlul Bayt, there are many forms of death. Fiqh, the Sharia, deals with only one aspect of death, and that's the physical death. And it has ahkam in relation to this death. And that ahkam is important. But here, we want to die from moment to moment. Don't forget, Irfan wants you to breathe the articles of faith in this world, whilst you're living, whilst you're young, day to day, moment to moment. It speaks of dying from moment to moment. And this is what they call voluntary death. There are two types of death. There's one or two types of suicide. One is a physical suicide, which is haram, to commit suicide. That kind of killing we're not dealing with here. But we have something called a spiritual death, or a spiritual suicide, if you like. Not killing the physical body, but eliminating traces of one's ego. As a result of detaching oneself from the worldly life, killing one's ego, then one transcends from this realm to a higher realm whilst living in this world. You're transcending. And death, according to the Urafa, means that a transition from one given realm to any higher realm, the higher realm being more immaterial than its lower realm. And there are infinite number of realms. And as you transcend from one realm to another, you're getting closer and closer to Allah. And that's what a proximity, qurb, means. Transcending the realms before you acquire unity with Allah. Zahiruka lilfana, your external side is to perish. Batinuka ana, your inner side is me. Allah is saying this. But you have to transcend these realms one after the other. Every transition to a higher realm is called death. That's the definition. Or if you like, death can be paraphrased as one step closer to Allah. But we only see death after a number of years of living in this world. But that's the minimum. And that's not spirit building, just dying as a result of old age. Because when one dies, one enters the next realm of, or becomes aware that one is now in Barzakh, which is a semi-immaterial realm of existence. But what good would that do? It's of no benefit anymore. You can transcend though in those metaphysical realms as a result of eliminating one's ego whilst living in this world, dying from day to day, moment to moment. Mutu abla an tamutu, the Holy Prophet said. Die before you die. This is the spiritual death. Die a spiritual death before you undergo the physical death. See, this is now everyone, it's based on the traditions here. Don't be scared of the word dying. It only means a transition from one realm to a higher realm, being closer to Allah. And the way to start off with is by following the Sharia. There are many things in the Sharia which are ego-breaking. They break the ego if you just abide by it. For example, not disappointing, not making one's parents angry. It's very difficult. Just observing, being obedient to whatever they say. Although in the Sharia it has one limit, but in Irfan there is no limit to obeying one's parents. It just says be a slave to them. In the Sharia it's a bit, the jurisdiction is less. But in Irfan it says just be a slave, just do whatever they say. Look how ego-breaking they can be. Just if they say to sin, then we don't accept, of course. See, these things are important. It's like salvation depends on it sometimes. And there are many things in the Sharia. Now, one's parents may be oppressive atheists. It doesn't matter. You still be a slave to them. But not anyone can do that 100%, but you can do, make an effort. Start with 10% at least, then grow. And you see, you will see the consequences spiritually building up just by obeying your parents. But the Sharia doesn't want that from you. The Sharia says you just shouldn't make them upset, make them angry, by doing things which on a par with their on a par with what common lay people in your society would regard legitimately as making your parents angry. That you're not allowed. For example, if you use bad language, well, the common lay person here would regard that as legitimate, something legitimately wrong by using bad language to one's parent. That's haram according to the Sharia. But I mean, if you want to choose a subject at university and your parents say no, I'm angry, I'm disappointed that you want to choose that. That the common lay person wouldn't regard as something which should legitimately make you aware. That wouldn't be haram according to the Sharia. But according to Irfan, it would be problematic. But it's not a sin. Because the Irfan wants you to break the ego. whatever your parents say, just do. Because one's fate, one's salvation lies in it. Especially in relation to the mother. So then we see that Islam offers other codes in the traditions. It says that An-namu akhul maut, sleeping is death's brother. What's all that about? Death meaning what? That transition to a higher realm. Sleeping is also the brother of death. Because when you sleep, because you're automatically detached from the worldly life, because you're asleep, because of that automatic detachment from the worldly life, you ascend to a higher realm. Now, be you Muslim or non-Muslim, everyone undergoes that ascension on sleeping. And you see yourselves, you experience the eye when you're asleep. And in those dreams, there's no physical matter anymore. That's the barzakhi realm now you're in. It's a very important journey that one undergoes when one sleeps. And the opportunity that Allah has granted is that we return. We wake up after our sleep, most of us. Then we can work on our spirituality stronger and stronger day after day. And that's why Islam, even for our sleeping, has offered a protocol of action before sleeping. Because Islam knows that the eye is to travel on sleeping. It's even provided an educational tool for the eye during one's sleep. It says, do the wudu as the wudu should be done, with all those esoteric meanings of the wudu. Recite some verses of the Qur'an properly. Prepare the soul for this journey. The purer the soul, the more you will benefit from dreams. Dreams aren't something to be scared of. Dreams are a means of communication between you and Allah. You can benefit a lot through your dreams. You can spiritually elevate Allah through your dreams. And if you acquire certitude in relation to what you see, that's proof for you, not for others though. If you want to demonstrate it to others, you have to explain that truth that you've acquired in your dreams in a rational framework. If you want to speak to others, you can't tell them, I had this dream therefore. Ar-Rubiyah Juz'un min al-Nubuwwah. Dreaming is a component of prophethood. We should take this lightly. Why? Because it's the mi'raji element, that ascending element of dreams that prophets would have too. Either in dreams or prophets like our Holy Prophet would have them whilst awake. What we have, those visions that we have when asleep, they would, as a result of the strong spirituality they had, being able to detach themselves from the world life in this world, whilst awake, they would be able to ascend and benefit. When they would undergo the mi'rajis, they were awake. Okay, so that was death. And then we speak of barzakh. We usually regard barzakh as happening and following after death, period. But barzakh exists now. Can it be experienced before physical death? Yes, it can. There's no need to wait for barzakh after physical death. You can transcend to barzakh through spirituality in this world. They discuss, is barzakh something material or immaterial? Here, all the scholars accept that this is an immaterial reality, barzakh. And it's just transcending from this worldly life to a higher semi-immaterial realm. And and spiritually elevating in the process. But if you just wait to enter Barzakh after physical death, well, you won't benefit much from there. It's too late then. And if you do benefit, it's something very minimal. Over here on Barzakh, I have spoken about it quite a bit. I don't really want to speak about it too much here, but you can find it online and everything. Then the questioning of the angels. What are angels? We have this understanding, this external understanding of it, that these physical entities with a number of wings. Then they knock on the Holy Prophet opens the door. I want to take you to this place. And that's okay. I'm not saying that's wrong. It's a minimum of your religion. But what are angels? See, the truth of angels is something mighty here. And then Sheikh Tusi calls Iblis an angel. And then many scholars attacked him. Even today you hear speeches sometimes where they bring Sheikh Tusi's statement to it. And they say, well, no, Iblis can't. When Iblis was more abiding, he couldn't have been an angel. Because in the Quran it says, Iblis was of the jinns. Well, don't you think Sheikh Tusi, Rahmatullah Alayh, knew that? He was a mufassir of the Quran. He was more than expert than me and you. It's because your understanding of what an angel is needs refining. These words of the Quran, before referring to their technical definitions, you have to refer to their literal definitions. With angels, the literal definition is a possessor of power. It comes from the root word uluka, which means faculty, power. Whatever is in possession of power applies to being an angel. And then there are angels technically who has a specific definition, which we'll come to that in a minute. But even jinns qualify as angels in this aspect of the word. And then here many verses of the Quran get more meaning here. So, are they physical though, or are they immaterial? Are the voices, when the angels speak, were they physical voices, or were they immaterial? If we say they were immaterial, so what does the verse فَتَمَثَّلَ لَهَا بَشَرًا سَوِيًّا mean in relation to Lady Maryam alayhi salam? Chapter 19, verse 17. She saw Archangel Gabriel. She saw, so there was color, shape, size. Couldn't have been something purely immaterial. But she saw Archangel Gabriel as a human being. What she saw, according to the Quran, was Archangel Gabriel. But it was a human being she saw. That human being was Archangel Gabriel. See now, what is an angel? Angels have two forms of existences. One is purely immaterial. In a purely immaterial realm, which knows of no time or place, which knows of no number or divisibility. So what does it mean then? We speak of thousands of angels, let's say. What these we speak of Jibreel, Mikael, Israfil. What's all that then? We're dividing them. But their true existence, the essence of what angels are, is something purely immaterial. Then they have another form of existence which is semi-immaterial or Barzakhi. And that Barzakhi manifestation of angels is a manifestation of that purely immaterial existence. And those angels manifest semi-immaterially upon any number of people at any time. Nakir and Munkar, the angels of the grave, if a million people die right now, the same angels will appear before a million people, not physically, that's impossible. Otherwise they won't be the same Nakir and Munkar. It's like when Amirul Mu'mineen appeared before 40 different people, forty different times, at the same time, in 40 different places. This was 1,400 years ago. Amirul Mu'mineen, alive and living. Then the next day, 40 people say, he was with me at that hour. Another said, no, he was with me. Someone said, he was with me. Those 40, they can't be 40 physical Amirul Mu'mineens. Because if they were 40 physical Amirul Mu'mineens with a brain, soul, and so on, then they weren't the same. That Amirul Mu'mineen can't be the same. It's rationally impossible. It goes against the law of transitivity. They were visions of Amirul Mu'mineen. I'll explain that in a minute. فَتَمَثَّلَ لَهُ بَشَرًا سَوِيًّا. Archangel Gabriel appeared as a vision, as an apparition, in the soul of Lady Mariam. When Lady Mariam saw Archangel Gabriel, the semi-immaterial human being, it was a dimension of her soul. Like what we see in our dreams. We see a person with size, shape, color. She saw a manifestation of Jibreel, but whilst awake, not with the physical eye. And if we were there next to Lady Mariam, we wouldn't see anything. Archangel Jim was in unity with her soul. It was a product of her soul. She reached a level where that purely immaterial existence manifested in that form and shape. That purely immaterial, indivisible reality. When that immaterial, indivisible reality descends in a semi-immaterial form and grants knowledge that you will have a child, that immaterial reality which transcends, descends into a semi-immaterial reality, if it gives knowledge, we call it Jibreel. If it gives life, that same immaterial reality, on descending to a lower realm, we call it Israfil. If it's in relation to providing sustenance, we call it Mikael. The essence is one, it's purely material. Allah is communicating with us through them. Amirul Mu'mineen is higher than Archangel Gabriel. It's a higher reality. Spirituality is much higher. And Amirul Mu'mineen can descend upon our souls in a semi-immaterial manner. Then those 40 would see Amirul Mu'mineen. And they would really think it was a physical Amirul Mu'mineen. Like in our dreams, we really think it's something real before we wake up. And he has that power also to descend upon many people at the same time. Even more than that, during the time of Ihtidhar, the last moments of death, before dying, the last breaths of life, the traditions are saying that everyone, Muslim or non-Muslim, will see Amirul Mu'mineen, alayhi salam. How? Even those who died during the time of Amirul Mu'mineen, they will see Amirul Mu'mineen during the last moments. But the semi-immaterial realm, the semi-immaterial Amirul Mu'mineen. And nadaro ila wajhi Ali ibadatun. Looking at the face of Ali is ibadah. Why? Is it the physical face of Amirul Mu'mineen? Well, the first, second, and third also would see Amirul Mu'mineen every day. Did they benefit spiritually? Was that ibadah? No, you're spiritually ascending and acquiring the capacity for Amir al-Mu'mineen to descend upon you semi-immaterially and experiencing that فَتَمَثَّلَ لَهُ بَشَرًا سَوِيًّا. That's what it means.
محمد عليه الصلاة
والسلام لا سلام محمد وآل محمد
صلوا على محمد وآل محمد
لا
deeper reality at stake here. If you believe it's a physical bridge, again, there's no problem with that. But to explore it more deeply, it would benefit you more. Does this Sirat exist now, or is it something else you're going to relate back to one day in the future? Here, Imam Khomeini, in his letter to his daughter-in-law, he gives a really important tradition there, which there's no time to speak about that now. But in after the tradition, he says this Sirat is here right now in this world. From action to action, you're building your Sirat. And then as a result of the actions that you do, that will manifest in a different way. It will be embodied in the hereafter. But the Sirat is right now, right here. And when they say the Sirat, the bridge, is thinner than hair, sharper than a sword, right now it's thinner than hair. It's the smallest step out of line, transgressing from the Sharia, will lead to very bad embodiments of those vicious actions that you do here. All your actions that you do, that you incorporate within your soul, that will be embodied in the hereafter. Everything is acquired here. Leaving things to after death is too late. Then the Sirat, is it outside the soul or is it within the soul? And here there are many versions of the Quran, Allah made up, we have spoken about them. I don't want to spend too much on commenting. I just want to offer these questions. In relation to heaven and hell, where is it? Is it a place? Is it physical or not? Can it be acquired before death? Is there a red monster with horns waiting for you there? A physical monster to whip you or to burn you? I mean, if we believe in that, which is okay to believe in that, but your understanding of Allah will be compromised. Because there's no need for Allah to punish. What kind of Allah is that? There's no need for Allah to punish you. Allah doesn't need your prayers, doesn't need your ibadat. And Allah doesn't punish you. You, as a result of your actions that you've incorporated throughout this life, those actions will be embodied in the hereafter. Heaven, hell, barzakh, sirat, they're all functions and dimensions of the soul. The soul is an infinite reality. Transcending the realms of heaven is transcending the realms of the soul. And that can be acquired in this realm. There's no need to believe in this physical place. Although if you believe it, and many theologians do, that's okay. Imam Khomeini didn't. Ayatollah Hassan Zadeh didn't. They believed in that semi-immaterial and immaterial realms of the hereafter. We don't need a body. It's very difficult to justify too. Aqa'id, there's no taqlid in aqa'id. You have to be careful. And just because it's semi-immaterial, it doesn't mean the joy there will be less. It will be much more. But the pain will be much more too than a physical pain. And then one has to discuss the rationale of divine punishment. These are things I've discussed before. Then we speak of the Mi'raj. What does the Buraq mean? Now this is something I haven't touched upon in detail before. What the Mi'raj is. Does history record a physical donkey, for example, called Buraq? Did other than the Holy Prophet see the Buraq? Well, the answer is no. Did the Holy Prophet move from Mecca to Masjid al-Aqsa? Was it a physical movement? Most of these scholars, even most of the Orafa, here they say it's okay, it was a physical movement. He moved with the physical body. But from Masjid al-Aqsa to the heavens, here the Orafa differ from the traditional theologians. They don't believe it was physical, because those realms are metaphysical. It's semi-immaterial and immaterial. There's nothing worldly about them. There's nothing physical about them. Ibn Sina believed even from Mecca the Holy Prophet didn't move. He uses the tradition that after the Mi'raj, the warmth of the place was still there. And then he has a treatise on Mi'raj, but that treatise is very deep on it. After studying it with an ustad, the last paragraph was that these are secrets for the Orafa which should be disclosed to the common layperson. And I usually don't like when people say that, because I think the common layperson, if they explain things very simply, they do have the capacity to understand. I mean, there's nothing deeper than the Quran. But the Quran descended in a simple manner for people to understand. That simple language as a conduit to its inner truths. So I did ask my ustad here, can I express these opinions of Ibn Sina on the manbar? Since he said no, you have to forgive him. But there are a lot one can say about Mi'raj. We don't have to confine it to what Ibn Sina said, but it was incredible. And those who are worthy of that knowledge, it's well worth the read. Then it happened at night. What does night mean? In Irfan, night and day, there are two different meanings. It doesn't mean the physical night and day. They have their own meanings. What is Masjid al-Aqsa here? What is Masjid al-Haram? Because there was no Masjid al-Aqsa at that time. It came later. Here Ayatollah Jawadi has written about this. The place was there, but it wasn't regarded as a masjid at that time. So what are the inner realities of Masjid al-Aqsa? This Ayatollah Jawadi says it's one of the miracles that it came to be. And here the Quran mentions such a place. But the place was there, but as a masjid, it wasn't introduced at that time. Then during the Mi'raj, all the prophets are said to have prayed behind our Holy Prophet. And one of the verses of the Holy Quran, chapter 43, verse 45, Was'al man arsalna min qablika min rusulina. Ask those amongst our messengers that we sent before you, the Holy Prophet. What kind of asking is this? And this was revealed during the Mi'raj. All those messengers came back, prayed behind the Holy Messenger. Now here we usually think that all the messengers came back in the physical form. First of all, history doesn't record such a thing. You know, the 124,000 prophets all coming. We don't have such an event in history. It's never been recorded. And if you believe that they came back in the physical form, now here things get delicate. Here, you see, aqaid, you can't do taqlid in aqaid. Here, if you believe they came back in the physical form, your belief is on a par with reincarnation. Although it's not impossible, but there are a number of prerequisites. But there's no need to believe that they came back in the physical form. In the discussion on Rajat, which I did a few weeks ago, this was touched in detail. But anyway, what Ayatullah Jawadi Omri, Hassanzada Omri, Imam Khomeini, the Urafah in general believe, they were all visions. Those prophets, those messengers were visions of the Holy Prophet. Like in your dream, you leading a prayer and there are people behind you. And then the Prophet would ask questions to those messengers during the Mi'raj. But this was'al man arsalna min qablika min rusulina, this asking those who we sent before you amongst the messengers, this is a code for me and you. It's not limited to the Holy Prophet. Mi'raj is open for me and you. As-salatu mi'rajul mu'min. Salat is the believer's mi'raj. We can ascend. We can see the prophets. We can benefit from them. In Ibn Arabi's Futuhat, he's seen many prophets. And the dialogue he's had with them, those visions of prophets that he had, he would record. And he had quite a lot of ma'rifah from those dialogues that he had. But he didn't see the physical. They've passed away now. And in one place he speaks of seeing the prophets from the previous cycles, before Adam, alayhi salam. Then there's a concept of Rajat, which I've spoken in great detail. 10 lectures, those who are interested can follow it. Usually we believe in a Rajat which will happen one day in the future, Rajat that can be applicable today. Then they speak of Messianism, Mahdawiyat. Now this I want to start, inshallah, from tomorrow. And I haven't talked about this before, the concept of the Mahdi, and this is an important concept now, Messianism, Mahdawiyya. Something which has been abused a lot. Something which has been understood minimally. Something which has only been understood the external dimension of, which is okay, it's no problem. But don't suffice with that external understanding of this holy, lofty, important, significant, essential to one's salvation, this matter. What does the zuhur mean? We usually say it will happen one day in the future, the reappearance of the Imam. The Urafa say the zuhur can happen from moment to moment, day after day, right now. It becomes a vast difference of understanding now. They keep on saying the zuhur will happen one day. Here they say we've undergone the zuhur. What do they mean though? This will be covered inshallah. It's not all about a physical advent, a physical zuhur, a physical reappearance. That will happen one day. It may happen in 100,000 years' time. How are you going to benefit from something which will happen in 100,000 years' time? That's the physical zuhur. The spiritual zuhur is to acquire it now. And very interestingly, today, when I checked alwilaya.com, the site, I don't know if the brothers or sisters, whoever organized it, there's this opening few sentences that they have. And actually the key to the zuhur of the Urafa can be found in those sentences. I really enjoyed it when I read it. And it shows that you as people who, alhamdulillah, respect a very important alim such as Sayyid Abbas Ilya, I wouldn't expect even less from you. That was a very good sight. And those comments, those statements were something very important underlying that. And that's what I'll be opening up even more. But the key lies in those sentences anyway. So how are we to benefit? How can we we do the Zuhur today, are there ways to see the holy Imam, the 12th Imam today? Is seeing the Imam only limited to a physical seeing? Is seeing the Imam physically of any value? Will that benefit us at all? As I say, many Munafiqeen, they saw Amir al-Mu'min every day. Did that benefit them? Those who see Amir al-Mu'min, the semi-immaterial, are the benefit. The same applies to the 12th Imam. What's the philosophy of the ghiba, the occultation? What's the philosophy of us not being able to see the physical Imam? What does it mean not to be able to be seen? Can that be explained rationally? Of course it can. It has to be. And we'll introduce some of these concepts in the next few sessions. What does awaiting for the Imam mean? Intidhar. How must we await for him? Does that also, is it confined to a physical awaiting? What does the uprising, the qiyam of the 12th Imam actually entail? Here again, qiyam, intidhar, zuhur, qaybat, these are all codes. Codes for unlocking the soul, the human soul. And these inshallah will speak about. And there are other many concepts in Messianism one can speak about, but we'll just speak about 3 days worth inshallah. And finally, that's the end of the talk, but in relation to Ashura, with your permission, I won't be reading Masayib tonight, but from tomorrow night I'll be reciting Masayib, just my voice hasn't really returned yet. But in relation to Ashura here, it's important to understand that the story of Ashura, like all stories in the Islamic texts, the Quran and the traditions, it's a story of the soul. The story has an external side to it. And we accept the external side to the stories of the Quran and the traditions. We don't negate them. But these physical stories have inner esoteric layers too. And the esoteric layers of all stories of the Quran and the traditions is the story of man. It's the story of the soul and how the soul elevates. How the soul becomes perfect. All stories in the Quran. If you read the stories of the Quran and confine it to the physical understanding and limit it to that, well, you're not going to be benefiting too much. And there are many books on history which go into those stories much more deeper than the Quran does. That's not the aim, it's not a book of history. It's a book of the soul. The Quran is a product of the soul of the Holy Prophet as a result of his mi'raj. Here, the Quran is a book of how the soul elevates. And all its stories in the Holy Quran, all stories, and even in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, all the stories possess codes. And those codes are keys to our salvation. They're codes which tell us either what the reason for spiritual downfall will be, and tells us how we have to spiritually elevate. They come in the form of stories. The story of Ashura too, in the highest degree, is a story of the soul, the human soul, and what it means for the soul to elevate. So, when the Quran speaks of the story of Talut, Saul, who wasn't a prophet, but he was a man of God, and Prophet Dawood was in his army. When the Quran speaks of Talut and Jalut, Goliath, commonly known in the Christian takes us the war between David and Goliath. Here, something happened in the physical world. There was a battle. But there are some codes which the Quran gives whilst giving an account of that physical story. First of all, the Quran says that Saul, Talud, says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ مُبْتَلِيكُمْ بِالنَّهَرِ. Allah is testing you with this stream, this river. The story was that they shouldn't drink from it. But most of them did, and they were dying of thirst. And they couldn't fight in that battle. The story is very lengthy. I don't really want to concentrate on the story. I just want to concentrate on the idea that the stories of the Quran are stories of how the soul elevates. You're tested with a stream that was there. It's speaking to us now. We are tested from day to day with the river, with a stream. Then Saul says, فَمَنْ شَرِبَ مِنْهُ فَلَيْسَ مِنِّي. That's a code. And this we have to focus on. Whoever drinks from the stream is not one of us. It's not one of mine. If you want to be one of His, one of Allah's party, one of Hezbollah, you can't drink from the stream. Now there was a physical event there which happened. Esoterically, the stream, and we derive this from the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, the stream is the worldly life. إِنَّ الدُّنْيَا بَحْرٌ. Verily the world is an ocean. فَقَدْ غَرِقَ فِيهَا جَيْلٌ كَثِيرٌ. Waves of people will get drowned in it. Whoever drinks from it is not one of mine. You want to be the party of Allah, you want to be Hezbollah, you can't drink from the worldly life. That doesn't mean don't live a worldly life. No. You study, you work, you get married, you have children, have a good job, have a good house. But if you get attached to it, when you want to elevate, and most people with the luxuries of life, which aren't bad per se, most people drown themselves. Now there's no need to think of people. Don't you just think of yourself. Most people are fooling themselves. It's very dangerous. It's very difficult. I'm not saying those who have a big house, big car, they won't go to heaven. No. They may have a heaven too. It's no problem. It's a minimal heaven though, if they get attached to the worldly life. You can't fool around with yourselves. But live the worldly life. Don't get attached to it. If you drink from the stream, you drink from the worldly life, you're not one of us. That's a code. Be careful. In this world, just be careful. And in the following sentence, it gives another code and the solution. Illa, except for. So whoever drinks from it is not one of ours. Except for. Illa man iqtarafa qurfatan biyadih. Except those who drink a handful from it. That which is necessary. Okay? And also the code. You living in this worldly life in America, naturally your standards of living differs from someone in Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Afghanistan, Palestine, everything. But on that which is on a par with the common layperson here, that's okay. That which is necessary for you. There are things which are necessities in life. That's okay. But don't make the extra step. You personally, your wife and children, in relation to men, they deserve more than the basic necessities, and if they want it, it's even mustahab to give it to them. But you only suffice with the necessities. And if you're a woman, your husband, your children, they have some rights, they can also deserve more than the basic necessities. And by basic necessity, even a computer today is a basic necessity, for example. In the mobile, the car, so on and so forth. It depends from culture to culture. The woman, in relation to her husband, children, they may ask for more than the basic necessities, and you may have a duty to provide, and you do, but in relation to yourself, you at least suffice for the basic. Everyone to their own self. You can't force your spouse, your children, to suffice with the basic necessities. This is an inner journey. You have to acquire that love to do such a thing. It's not an academic exercise anymore. And there are many codes like this. Another code is in the story of Noah, Prophet Noah, alayhi salam, wa Noah, Nuhone benahu, and Prophet Noah called upon his son, and he was in the ark, the son was outside the ark, the floods were rising, وَكَانَ فِي مَعْزِلٍ, whilst the son, Noah's son, was standing aloof. That has a physical understanding, an external side to it, but esoterically, it's giving a code here. Code in relation to the soul. Don't stand aloof in society. You have to be with the people. And you, as Americans, you have to be with the Americans. You can't grow by standing aloof. And it's a very logical thing to say this. The cause of Prophet Noah's son's downfall was staying away from the people of that time. Now maybe one understanding of this, and Imam Khomeini in his 40 hadith has alluded very indirectly to one or two esoteric dimensions of the story of Noah. Not this one though. You can't grow spiritually if you're standing aloof from the people, if you segregate yourself from the people. Because how are you going to acquire divine attributes if you always are separate from the people? How are you going to be a manifestation of Allah's patience? How are you going to be generous? How are you going to be forgiving? All these divine attributes are dependent upon living with the people. And in your case in America, it's living here. To be very careful here. Your spirituality here is deep. Now, okay, some of you, by being with the people, it may happen that you feel that your spirituality will be compromised with. Your faith will be lost. Okay, there's a point in there. But for goodness sake, just evaluate yourselves. Don't force other people to do that. If you're weak and you can't tolerate being with people, that's okay. You know yourself best. But don't give these generalizations to especially our youth. That's you. Let them live their own lives. Just give them the criteria. If they believe that their faith will be destroyed, yes, then you tell them to keep away. Otherwise, they won't reach that perfection that we're all deserving of. Now, in the massacre of Karbala, the maqtals, these maqtals that we have, they're infiltrated with codes. Now, there's an external side to the massacre of Karbala, which the maqtals do portray, and that's a very important aspect to the maqtal. And the fact that it gives rise to these emotions within is a good thing. We can't suddenly come and say that people who just cry are listening to even that external aspect of the maqtal. The maqtals have a lot of esoteric dimensions to them. We'll come to that in a minute. But even those who cry in relation to the external side, when they hear someone is being beaten or this is happening or that's happening, when they cry, even that's okay. They will benefit, albeit minimally, but there is benefit in it. It softens the heart, and I'll speak a bit about that tomorrow. You can't put the maqtals aside. We've been having this for 1400 years. This is an important tradition. And something similar to the maqtals existed in relation to the massacre of Karbala, even before the Holy Prophet and Imam Hussein alayhi salam. This was something, it was a truth which led to crying in relation to prophets even. But the prophets would understand the esoteric dimensions of the maqtals too. We have to make sure to abide by this important tradition that we have in our religion, but also try and explore these inner esoteric codes in the maqtals. That's important. And it's these maqtals are infiltrated with these codes. And these maqtals, which are accounts of the massacre of Karbala, it's like others, like the stories of the Quran, it's all a story of the soul. How the soul grows. Something happened physically 1,400 years ago. It was a horrific event. We have to recall it as much as we can. But more importantly, it's those inner codes that the maqtals offer. I'll just offer a few examples here. One code in the maqtal is called the Qasimi code. There was someone called Qasim, son of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, 13 years of age. Imam Hussein had said that tomorrow we'll all be martyred. Qasim was there. And since he was a child, he thought, does this apply to me too? You see, this is a code for me and you, for the Qasimi dimension within us to be realized. Imam Hussein said, well, he's a child, let's test him to see whether this is meant out of the heart or not. Qasim, how do you evaluate death? How do you see death? Now here comes the code. Sweeter than honey. Now look, Qasim acquired this capacity at 13. The capacity is there for us to acquire. We can realize and manifest that Qasimi dimension within us. That's the story of Karbala. That's how we have to benefit spiritually from it. He said it's sweeter than death. Sweeter than honey. Death is sweeter than honey. What's death? We've explained what death is. That transition to a higher realm.